As Tolstoy says, happy families are all alike. Every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And so, it's any wonder that stories about dysfunctional families are such fertile ground for filmmakers. Griffin Dunne stars in a new film, Ex-Husbands, and in the hands of writer and director Noah Pritzker, the story of the Pierce family as it unfolds in Ex-Husbands is told with a wealth of empathy and wry humor, making for a particularly enjoyable bit of moviegoing. It's a great cast with James Norton, Roseanne Arquette, and Richard Benjamin, and Griffin Dunne in a welcome return to a leading role. He effortlessly anchors the film. Join writer-director Noah Pritzker and actor Griffin Dunne as we discuss their new film, Ex-Husbands, on Inside the Art House, starting now.
Hi, everybody. It's Greg Lemley here, and welcome to another episode of Inside the Art House. Today, I'm joined by writer-director Noah Pritzker and lead actor and executive producer Griffin Dunne, and they're going to be talking to us about their new film, Ex-Husbands. Thank you for joining us here on Inside the Art House.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Greg.
So, Noah, I guess the film really, conversation starts with you. Where did the film come from?
The film came from my parents had decided to separate around the same time that my brother had decided to get engaged to marry. The wedding itself was a very intimate wedding with just their immediate families. By the time they got married, it was all two divorced families, and those were the only guests of the wedding. I think I spent a lot of that wedding just thinking about both the courage to take this plunge and make these vows in front of exclusively divorced people, and sort of the absurdity and the beauty in that. And that got my wheels turning, and I didn't know exactly what story I wanted to tell, but kind of started writing. At first, what I thought was this kind of very broad comedy about this father crashing this bachelor party. And as I started writing it, it moved away from The Hangover and kind of toward something else, you know, a style that I guess just it maybe comes a little more naturally to me. Then the character of Peter kind of started to emerge and started following him around and became very kind of intrigued by this man in his 60s, trying to figure out what his identity would be post divorce after his parents are ailing and one has died. And he's kind of no longer a husband. He's no longer a father to young children. And kind of who is he now at this phase of life? And was incredibly lucky to find Griffin and a collaborator at a fairly early stage of this project.
So how early did Griffin become attached or become aware of the script and I guess maybe involved in the script taking it from there around
pre-COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a point pre-COVID where we had a bunch of cast involved around Griffin and thought it was going to happen. And then obviously everything shut down. You know, Griffin and I throughout that stayed in touch. And, I would go back to the script on days where I was, you know, locked in my house and didn't have much else to do and had probably just had a conversation with Griffin and would, you know, rewrite a scene thinking about Griffin or a conversation or a story he had shared. And then by the time we were actually going to make this movie, I think Griffin and I had a real shorthand, and actively and passively had spent so much time talking about this script and about movies and the movies we loved and the references. And, you know, by the time we went to go make the movie, I felt like I was kind of going off with a buddy.
Griffin, what is it about the script that resonated with you? Are there personal echoes, I guess, in life? Or, I mean, you're no stranger to family dysfunction on screen, having directed, you know, Fierce People.
Yeah, and having lived it. I've been married a couple times. I've got a grown daughter who's moved out of the house, who's in the same age as these characters. The kids playing my son. And you know, I've lost my father. I've lost both parents. I'm an orphan, you know, a grown up orphan. So it's very rare that a script comes along with the central character of a guy in his 60s who faces these issues. So I recognized immediately when I read it just how fortunate I was to be in Noah's radar for this. And it did sort of speak to me that, the kind of sense of humor I have where, you know, it kind of goes funny, sad, and I like the texture and the colors that were in the script. It's not broad. It doesn't force itself for a laugh. And they come up, earn the laughs out of, you know, anxiety and fear and change and trying to reach out and connect and failing miserably. That's the funny stuff.
I don't know about failing miserably. I think there's a lot of success in the film and the family. And
no. I mean, when you're trying to, the character trying, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's always reaching out to Miles and, you know.
Yeah.
It misses.
Well, look, it's a very generous film in the sense that while we look at the foibles and the problems of each generation, there's also just so much love. We need drama in the film, so there has to be an enemy. There has to be, you know, or not an enemy even, there has to be a villain. And there just isn't in this picture. To me, that speaks, you know, more to the honesty of it. It's very similar to my own situation. I'm a child of divorce. Let's take a look. Thank you. Is there a couch somewhere I can lie down on? Yeah. What did your therapist say about making the film?
I was going to say, lift the armrest.
We're with you
all the way.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, you get two for the price of one. Here with me and Griffin.
Let's take a look. I want to look at a clip because it'll really hopefully set off the conversation.
What is going on?
I don't know.
What, is this some sort of prank?
No, he's not supposed to be here.
Because I'm really not in the mood for it, man.
Wait, you didn't know he was coming? No. He told me he had a ticket. He said that he booked the trip without realizing he would be there.
What?
Yeah, he said that Papa told him to book
Papa the trip. Can't speak!
I know. Don't shoot the messenger.
But why didn't you ask him to reschedule?
I did, and he said that he would.
Okay. Yeah, well, so clearly this was where the film was going, you know, in the sitcom direction. Broad comedy, Weekend at Bernie's sort of thing. I don't know. but that's not the movie.
That's where I thought I had a studio pick on my hands. And then everyone's lives kind of head in a different direction. Yeah, that's, you know, sort of where you get the premise of this movie, of this father crashing this bachelor party. I think Griffin's character is sort of quixotic and deluded in his notion that he never knew. I really think Peter has convinced himself, or memory holds, ever having heard about his son's bachelor party, and kind of has this feeling of like, what does my life have to do with yours? Like, what does me being in Tulum on my own journey have anything to do with you being in Tulum on your own journey? You don't need to include me in anything. I can be there having my fun and you can have yours. I think is ironically wrestling with how his father's decision to leave his mother so greatly impacted him, even though he's in his 60s, he's got children of his own, and in practical terms, it should have no bearing on his own life. And yet, it does. And I think he's sort of passing on that idea to his own children to try to reclaim his own autonomy and independence of like, well, now it's my turn to do what I want to do.
And I think there's something that happens that, unfortunately, I have entered an age where I totally know this is possible, where your kid can tell you something. It could be recorded. It could be on record. And your memory is very selective. You remember what you want to remember, and you have no memory, any recollection of what you didn't want to know. And it's like it's decided from out. There's an outside committee in your brain that decides what you hear and what you don't.
Well, I think if we had Roseanne Arquette, she would probably say, who plays your wife or ex-wife, as the case may be in the film, she'd probably say, no, that's why I left him.
Without a doubt.
I was constantly telling him things and he never remembered anything.
I think it's a testament to Griffin's performance too, that he makes the character feel so grounded that, you know, by the end, he's doing incredibly outrageous things, and yet I think I'm biased, but I think they feel completely credible, and you believe that he's doing this, you know, around the burial of his own father. You know, there are these questions about Griffin and what he knew and what he didn't know, and he seems so reasonable and sane, and yet he's capable of dismemberment. It's, I think, a testament to Griffin's performance that you still believe that it comes from this very warm, tender, loving place. And, you know, the question of like, why would what happened? Why would anyone ever leave Peter Pierce? It's like, well, his behavior is pretty far out there. And yet I think Griffin is able to imbue him with this kind of warmth and tenderness and humor and this kind of wonderful wry ability that he might be in on the joke. The joke is never entirely on him. And I think there's something in that that makes him a very intriguing character and performer of trying to figure out how much he does know.
To what extent, after you had cast the film, did you sit with the cast, table read, rehearse, and really sort of work the script into a you know, what we see on screen as a finished shape?
Sort of a funny shoot because we prepped in Mexico City. Tulum was just not a feasible place to prep the film. So we were in Mexico City. I was there for about a month. Griffin, James, and Miles and some of the guys in the bachelor party came down, I want to say a week maybe before we started shooting. So I had probably 3 days of costume fittings and rehearsals where we would do table reads, me, James, and Miles, and Griffin, and kind of mark up the script and lines that didn't feel right or questions they had. And that was incredibly helpful. Then we shot a few days in Mexico City and then had another week down between that and Tulum, and then another week down between that and New York City. So there were these kind of built-in breaks to recalibrate. And it was a very new experience for me of kind of rewriting as we went along. And in the breaks, I would kind of think about what we had shot and what was coming up next. It was mostly shot sequentially. And, you know, it's always it's a slippery slope rewriting during production, because sometimes you had a better idea of what it was supposed to be beforehand and you stick to the blueprint. As I got to know Griffin and Miles and James and had a sense of their characters, I, you know, had the benefit of some time to recalibrate as we went, which was, I think, a gift.
Now, when you say it was shot sequentially, did you shoot the initial New York scenes, then take the break and go to Mexico?
No.
And
so,
then come,
yeah.
Not fully sequentially.
Not fully, but the apartment stuff is all shot in Mexico City. Griffin's apartment, right, his New York City apartment, is in a new neighborhood in Mexico City where, you know, it's like all of these condos. And the nice thing about condos from a filmmaking standpoint is they could be
the
anywhere. So Griffin's apartment is actually in Mexico City. So we did that first. We did the airplane stuff at a famous studio there in Churubusco, which actually Griffin's aunt wrote a wonderful essay about, which our sound guy, who is a real Griffin fanatic, was very excited about this confluence of events of Griffin coming to the studio. And then the exterior New York stuff in Nick's apartment were in New York. So it sort of just worked out that way that the New York stuff was actually kind of shot sequentially too.
Oh, great.
Just because of how we were, you know, cheating it.
You talked about decapitation. That's not real, is it? Did that come from, was that, you know, an experience from your life?
So I, you know, growing up in a Jewish family, there was a lot of conversation around, I don't know if this is just a fascination or neuroses around death and morbidity. But there was a lot of conversation around burial and cremation and tattoos. And as a kid, I remember this argument my parents would have about my dad wanted to be cremated. My mom thought that was an affront against her and the religion. And as a kid, I just thought it was so ridiculous and sort of disturbing and sort of hilarious that there was this anxiety about what was going to happen between them. What would their relationship be when they were no longer here? And I think it's sort of, I remember writing that scene. It was in a later draft. Some of the stuff between Griffin and his father sort of helped me weave my way through the beginning and the end. It just felt so perfect for this to become the fixation of Griffin's, that like he is going to, you know, his father has made this decision to leave the family late in life, and Griffin is going to force him back into the family when he no longer has free will. And there was something to me that sort of summed up Griffin's character in the whole movie of the absurdity of, you know, family togetherness.
Yeah, I had a lot to draw on because as an Irish Catholic playing a Jew, as an Irish Catholic, you know, my grandparents, you know, had open casket funerals in their living, in the casket, in the living room. And, you know, the story we grew up with was my grandmother looking down at her husband and then looking at a big leather chair, saying to her children, grief-stricken that she wanted to have him stuffed and put in his favorite chair. My father and his siblings fell on the floor laughing. They were kids. And I've always grown up on that story about having someone stuffed and put in their chair. It's just an early childhood memory. So yeah, we have a lot.
I just got an amazing message from a friend who had seen the movie, who had said that he was thinking about the end of the movie because he just got back from a funeral that was a doubleheader. The grandmother and grandfather, they died about a year apart, but they had never got around to doing a funeral for the grandfather. So they did two. And he was telling me about a conversation with the rabbi. And one of the kids got very upset because they said, you know, you're weighing this so much more heavily towards my mother, who just died, and it's both of their ceremonies. And the rabbi said, this is my first doubleheader. You're going to have to bear with me. I'm trying to figure it out. I've never done this before.
It was a two for Tuesday.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's look, I am in a period of Shloshim, which is the 30 days following the death of a parent.
I'm sorry.
Just lost my father. So the movie hits very hard in that respect, but look, it's something. If we're lucky, we all experience burying our parents.
And better than the other way around.
Better than the other way around, and certainly better for the parents, I guess, in that respect as well. But it's just, you know, it's something we all face, and I think something that, you know, people have been facing for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, you can't go anywhere in the world, whether it's in Tuscany, you know, and looking at Etruscan tombs or anywhere and not realize that people have, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, sending their loved ones off and what that means to them. You know, it was very touching for me personally, but I think also, you know, and something about the characters that we learn about them as they're going through this process. But yeah, my own personal experience, I mean, my father lost his second wife 35 years ago, and they had a double plot, which they had arranged for. I think my father didn't, you know, necessarily think that he would find love again, but he did. Yet he never updated his funeral arrangements. So I'm like sitting there saying, you know, Dad, all right, you know, maybe you and Michelle should talk about this and make arrangements. Every couple of years, I would remind them to think about it. You know, never happened. So here we are. We're burying my father with his second wife. My stepmom.
So he's in there with the ex?
He's in there with not the ex. I mean, she passed away. They never divorced.
Wife is still alive.
And his current wife is sitting there saying, well, I'm putting him in the grave with the second wife. You know, and meanwhile, you know, my father was married three times. So my mother, who was the first wife, is still alive. She wasn't at the funeral, but, you know, all of us kids are there. And the kids from all three marriages are standing around, whether, you know, yours, mine, and ours, just commenting on the craziness of it all.
Is there room for a triple?
I'm working on it.
But it is sort of amazing how, you know, the dynamics continue in the, you know, even when the people are, when the, some of the people are gone, it's like the family dynamic is still there. I went to my grandpa's, my mother's father's funeral in Chicago last year. There's a mausoleum, not quite as grand as the Pierce Mausoleum, but a mausoleum. And one of the brothers didn't want to be in the mausoleum, but wanted to be outside of it. And so ended up having a plaque, but it's like so close to the mausoleum, you have to step over it. It's so, you know, in the way of everything else. And it was sort of somehow, it was like a fuck you to like obstruct the entry to the mausoleum. And it was just very interesting to me of like how you get your last word.
Griffin, was it hard to growing up in an Irish Catholic household, was it hard to become a Jewish New Yorker, Paul Pierce? Or I guess you've spent enough time with other Jewish New Yorkers.
I certainly have. And you know, when I started as an actor, I was only cast as Jews, from being a Warsaw ghetto fighter to I don't know what, I looked like Jewish light or something. And so I had a lot of practice. They didn't need to be as, you know, stringent and convincing or something. So it was refreshing to go back playing. It comes to me naturally. The humor and anxiety is And the humor that comes out of, you know, real life situations, I think applies to both Catholics and the Jewish.
And what about the challenge of stepping back into a lead role?
I fell into it quite gracefully.
I would agree.
I mean, I was like, oh, this feels good. Look at number one on the call sheet. That hadn't been a while. And you
sadly
know, I was just surrounded by the actors, you know, particularly Miles and James, who played my son, who I felt such rapport, such simpatico. There was no talk, no like, what am I doing? What is our thing? We just knew each other from hello. So there was never like pressure of like, oh, I'm carrying the film or any of that kind of stuff. I just thought if I just sort of stuck to the tone of the script and the reality of the character and, you know, that it would all sort of work out.
Well, it really did. And actually, let's take a look at your speech at the bachelor party at the dinner table.
Make it there.
Cheers. Cheers.
You'll make me cry. I don't want to.
Thanks, man.
Cheers, boy.
May I, Nick?
Come on, little beers.
Well, again, I want to thank you for including me. You did not have to do that.
Well, he sort of did.
No, actually, he didn't. So, thank you. And Mickey, what a thoughtful brother you are to have pulled all this together.
Can we make this into a roast? This is still a bachelor party. Come on, this is not your daughter's quinceañera.
Lowry, just shut the fuck up.
Okay, shut up. I'll shut up.
Thank you. Okay. Young Nicholas, a.k.a. Mr. Sunshine, presented quite a parenting challenge. He was smarter than his mother and I from the moment he came out of the womb. I remember his kindergarten teacher had Maria and I sit down to say that he was too smart for kindergarten.
Wow.
So he goes to the first grade, and then we get called back by his first grade teachers to have the same conversation. Now, it's pretty intimidating as a parent when your kid's teachers keep saying that he's a genius. You know, we didn't want to hold you back, but we did worry what skipping 2 years would do to you socially. But I think looking at this group around you, Nick, I don't think much social damage was done. I think you got yourself a pretty solid cadre. You know, with save Lowry, who I don't get it. I never got it. He's such an unpleasant, odd little man.
I love you too.
But, you know, in all seriousness, you know, as you guys get older and your lives start to take shape, you're going to have to work harder to find time for each other. But it is well worth the effort. Because you're really going to want to have these friendships when you're my age. I'm just so excited for your journey. I love you, Nick.
Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you, Noah. Gonna have to ask you to write my wedding my wedding speech next time one of my kids gets married. But again, it's so great to see a film from someone from the younger generation looking at their parents and seeing not only the problems and the problems that maybe, you know, have haunted them as they're growing up, but still seeing the humanity in their parents and a certain real and tender quality.
Sort of
to the
other
film.
Side of the coin of my first movie I made when I was in my 20s, and I think was like sort of all of the angst of family life. And I think, I mean, not that the movies don't have much to do with each other at all. But I think, yeah, just what you said, it was kind of looking at it from a very different perspective.
Well, I guess you're a parent now?
I'm a parent now, yes. Yeah. So that changes things. I had newly become a parent when we first set out to make this. I think there's probably a lot of that anxiety baked into this film. I don't know how much of it was processed at the time, because it was all very new. And, you know, one of the nice things about making movies is you can funnel all of your anxiety into it.
There's nothing like arguing with a four-year-old to, you know, who you love and adore and will defend against anything in the world, and yet they won't do what you want them to do.
Not at all. Not cooperative. Yeah, and I also think, you know, getting to know Griffin and him taking on this character and having real affection and tenderness for him allowed me to, I think, to have a warmth for his character that I think shines through.
Well, I guess seeing also seeing your parent, who you've had all this angst built up over years with, and but then seeing them as a grandparent can also be a very different kind of experience.
Certainly,
way to you know, look at your parents a little differently when you see that. And then, of course, as they get older, you also see a different side of them, become a little more childlike again, perhaps.
Yeah, if they ever grew up.
What's that?
If they ever grew up.
If they ever grow up. Yes. Well, they do and they don't.
Yeah. Remains a fixation of mine. You know, I always like, I fantasize about graduating from writing about families, and then I find myself going back to it over and over again.
It's an endless source of, you know, of stories and fascinations. And again, and it's universal. We all have to deal with parents. We don't all have to deal with siblings, but many of us do. And certainly looking at that, at those interactions, and then that extended family group, of course, the friends who we've all grown up with and know and go back so many years with, and seeing how they're growing up and how that's all changing. So it's very real. And it's played not as Sturm und Drang. It's not, you know, but it's not broad comedy either. It's really a wonderful and beautiful amalgam of something that just feels very real.
Thank you. And I think Griffin was helpful leading the charge on that, just always wanting, you know, it was like never playing it for laughs or for sorrow, but kind of trying to find the truth in it. And then I think also both of us were aware of wanting his character, you know, to be multifaceted and not playing it the same scene to scene. Oh, to do that, of finding what felt truthful, but also something, a new aspect of Peter, was sort of like the mandate of the day.
But you know what helped with that, and not to cross plug, but you know, I was writing my book while I was shooting.
You have to edit this part out, Greg.
Yeah, just take it out. But it's all about family. I'm tying it to here. Watch how I'm gracefully doing this. I was writing
a memoir. Land the plane?
I'm writing a memoir. It's called The Friday Afternoon Club. I don't know if you ever read it. And I would learn so much about family writing about mine to be in your movie. Boom, I did it.
Is that right. Hardcover, Griffin, or is the paperback coming
well,
up?
It's funny you should say.
Copies will be available at the concession stand.
Free popcorn with purchase.
I couldn't figure out how to sneak that in. Anyway.
No, it was perfect. So the film is Ex-Husbands. It's opening on February 28th in New York and Los Angeles. I know here in L.A., we're going to be screening at the Monica in Santa Monica and the Town Center in Encino. And you can go to lemley.com for more information. Where are you opening in New York?
We're opening at Village East by Angelica on 2nd Avenue on the 21st of February. So
a week ahead. So that'll be a week ahead.
A week ahead of L.A. And we'll be doing Griffin, James, Miles, and I will be doing Q&As in New York. And then we're going to come out to L.A. And then we'll go up to San Francisco and get the gang back together for one last hurrah.
When is it screening in Tulum, I guess? So maybe
that's the question. We got to figure that out. I think we're all still, I don't know that we're ready yet to return.
Where can people go to get information? Greenwich Entertainment, or is it?
Greenwich Entertainment is probably the best place to go. Otherwise, Lemley and Lemley Theaters. What is you have your—
Our URL is lemley.com, just Lemley.
Yeah, but I think it's all aggregated on Greenwich's website as well.
Terrific. And anything else you want to add? Anything we didn't cover?
No, thanks so much for having us. We're excited to come to the theater and show it.
Thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, Griffin. Thank you all for joining us on Inside the Art House. Please come back. If you liked it, subscribe. And we'll be back for more. But in the meantime, go look for Ex-Husbands. It's worth seeing.
Our show was produced by Raphael Sparge with on-site producer Naren Dickerson. Supervising producers are Miles McCreary and Thomas Cassetta. Our show was edited by Gabriel Lemley and mixed by Thomas Cassetta. Our musical theme was composed by Isabel Engman and Gerardo Garcia Jr. Marketing by Gabriel Lemley. Show graphics by Jenna DeAngelis and show open edited by Rick Pratt. Filmed at the historic Lemley Royal Theater in Los Angeles, California. See you next time.
on Inside the Art House. If you like today's show, please consider subscribing to our channel to hear more on Inside the Art House.